they have the money, but because of what they're involved in, having that money, and the fear, of course, of losing. I think I told you that during the Depression period, I'm told that not a single Pullman car came into the Chicago Central Station without always some suicides in every Pullman car. So, while we're talking about not temporal prosperity in some crude sense, but temporal, well, peace, temporal harmony, temporal happiness. Take, for example, justice. Without the church's teaching, there is no justice. But we find now, so many countries in the world don't even respect, as we know, unborn human life. 115. The papal primacy is a revealed dogma of the Catholic faith. Yes. In other words, that the Vicar of Christ, Bishop of Rome, has supreme authority. That's what primacy means. Supreme authority over everyone in the church on earth and implicitly over everyone in the world, spiritually. All the laws of all nations must be judged for their justice or injustice by the norms set down by the Catholic Church, of which the Bishop of Rome is the head. Then, encircling the terms, 116, the Church's Catholicity means her universal diffusion. All three would be correct, but number two is the best. Catholicity, as you know, means universality. But even now, after almost 2,000 years, less than one third of the human race is even nominally Christian. And it is not because Christ does not want his gospel preached everywhere. It can only be because those who have the faith have not diffused it. All I can tell you is, and the closer I get to eternity, the more serious I become in telling people, look, soon enough you'll be an empty chair. You won't even remember. Because we have a necrology, the list of all the Jesuits any given day who have died in the, well, we call them Missouri, Chicago, Detroit provinces. And each day we have names, sometimes 10 or 15 names on a given day, commemorating that person's death. Well, in other words, we're all going to disappear. We remain alive, our souls remain alive. But our duty, and I keep insisting, an obligation we have to diffuse, to spread the faith. And on occasion, depending on whom I'm talking to, I find people dozing off in the middle of what I'm saying is at the wrong bottom of our very existence. And when you see how zealous those who don't have the true faith are, well, no word I can use would be adequate. Take, for example, I mentioned the Protestants. After the Second World War, when some 60 new nations came into existence, would have been especially the colonial empire of the British, those of the French, and others. Over 40 new countries in Africa alone. that never existed came into existence. It's the Second World War. Well, I think I mentioned to you the Protestants who had been, well, established in many countries, in India alone. And Mahatma Gandhi died, there were some 200 Protestant denominations in India alone. Now Gandhi said, no more. No Christians. No evangelization. In, well, what is it? Since 1948, so it's at 44 years. No missionary, no Christian missionary has been allowed to evangelize in India. He's thrown out of the country. And of course, Catholic Church has suffered. But in countries where the Catholic Church had already been established, where there were millions, say, of non-Christians. And I think I've shared with some of you that I work very closely, in the sense I know so well so many of the leaders in world Protestantism, that almost overnight, whole nations could no longer receive any Protestant missionaries. The Catholic Church, by and large, had been established. For example, our own Jesuit provinces in India, they began to grow. In fact, now our mission in India, Patna, India, where we started the mission some 7 years ago, they now have more Jesuit vocations in India than we have in the whole Midwest. What would the Protestants do? The billions, not millions, the billions of dollars which they have spent for a couple of centuries in evangelizing, you know, the non-Christians, they now are concentrating billions on, as they call it, converting Catholics, Roman Catholics, to Christianity. The most powerful television stations in Latin America are in the hands of these fundamentalists, Mormons, Pentecostals. Here we talk about ecumenism. I know ecumenism, but I also know what it means to steal the faith, Catholic faith, from millions. And as I say, I talk this language to whatever audience I speak to. And, well, most audiences are just blasé. I guess I should show more, a little more concern with the very idea. I think I told you about the two Mormons that came to see me in New York, sent by the Mother Church of Salt Lake City. I never met them before, two well-dressed men. And so they called it beforehand. They came over, we met, we talked. They were sent by the Mother Church to convert Father Harden. Well, and they were paid transportation from Utah to New York. And talking to them, first of all, I told them, I just marvel at your zeal. And after an hour, they wanted to leave. I said, no, you stay put. I wasn't being paid, but to at least clear up some of their ignorance. And you see what I'm after. And the purpose of these meetings that we're having here is not merely to add out a few more footnotes to the theology. It's to motivate you people in God's own time and way, but you've got to want to do it. That's what life is all about. Either we share what God has given to us, or we won't reach heaven. Period. And the most precious thing we've got is not food or bodily drink. most precious possession we've got is our faith. By the way, we normally have a question box. Could I lend this black cover? And if you have any questions, we don't have our normal caretaker here, so number 117, the blood of martyrs is the seed of Christians. It is the mark of the church. It is proof of the church's divine authority, all three. But the historic term is the blood of martyrs is the seed of Christians. In other words, in his ordinary providence, God enables the church to grow through the suffering. We speak of red martyrdom and white martyrdom, or martyrdom of blood and, you know, martyrdom of witness, of courage. And the second we're all called upon to do, believe me. In other words, there's a relationship. And this, of course, is what's happening because of our media. That a person's reputation or the loss of his reputation, all it takes is one telephone call to a major, say, newspaper. And a person's reputation can be destroyed for life. And yet on the other hand, for those who are, to use the common word nowadays, dissenters. McBrien, Kung, Skelebex, and the rest of them. You name the publicity, for example. Some of you may have heard about a Father James Cavanaugh, spelled with a K. He was from Kalamazoo. And when I taught there in Western Michigan, I came to know the Cavanaugh family. His brother John, who was a gynecologist, and then John's wife Ruth, who is living, of course, I came to know Father James Cavanaugh. Well, he was a priest ordained a few years. He wanted to go on for special studies in theology. So I knew the bishop. So I had a meeting with the bishop and in Lansing. And he asked me, what did I think? Did I think that James Cavanaugh had the intelligence he wanted for a doctorate? Whether that would be wasting money and getting on the studies, and then he wouldn't maybe flunk his final exams or something. So then I met and I told Father Cavanaugh that I was asked by your bishop to kind of give you the once over, see if you qualify for doctoral studies. Yeah. He was not all that intelligent, but he was bright. And I figured he could weave his way through a doctoral program. And he wove his way through all that. He ended up writing the doctoral thesis at Princeton. So he got his degree from Catholic University. Well, he got his doctorate, and then the bishop, this is post factum, told me that he was in his office and told the bishop, "Well, bishop, sorry, there was nothing in the Diocese of Lansing that would satisfy me." Gosh. I'm guessing 40, 50,000 easy they spent in giving him this doctorate degree. So what could the bishop do? Because okay, what can the Pope do? What do you do with the stubborn will? What does God do? That, by the way, is why there's a hell. But in this life there's a limit. So then not long after, about a year or so later, he came out with a book. If you can get a copy of the book, read it. It's called A Modern Priest Looks at His Outmoded Church. Have you heard the title? Get a copy. Somewhere I have a copy, but I may read every page. Not all that profound, but well, and that's some years ago. I taught at Weston from 62 to 67. And then, so he told me, because after he broke with the church, I tried to, well, straighten him out. I said, Jamie, they call him Jamie, don't you realize what you're doing? He was just so bloated in mind. He told me, I have no reason for doubting it, that he had invitations from 200 American television stations when he published that book. Many of you you have some idea. You couldn't imagine your wildest nightmare. The organized, devastating, and phenomenally successful destruction of the Catholic Church in our country. Yet it is successful. And this is one means. And anybody, for example, a Catholic wants to say something about the Catholic faith, well, television prices are very high. So, you're talking about the blood of martyrs. And remember, this is not only being positively persecuted, it's being ignored, being shunted, priests removed, as you know, from parishes. Priest that I knew in a diocese, yeah, already in a couple of years, one Sunday just thought, bright young priest in his zeal, went to a good seminary, thought he'd give his two homilies of the two masses he had on Sunday against contraception. By the end of the week, he was out of that parish. I am not fabricating. That is why. And now, how many of you, I'll be very honest with you, only God knows, and it's not important, how many of you will be really bona fide, honest to God, Ignatian catechists. But those who will be, as far as in me lies, I want to make sure that you both know your faith and you're living it. The faith is not academics. Faith is life. And so the blood of martyrs, it's real. I think I told you, quoting Carl O'Connor, told me on one occasion. He said, I envy, when I mentioned about the country needing more St. John Fishers, and the bishops like St. John Fisher were told, you know, Henry VIII to jump into the Thames, remember? So Henry VIII, of course, executes John Fisher. So Colonel O'Connor told me, I'm sure I told some of you this, I envy John Fisher because he was thrown in jail, they cut off his head, and he's a saint. Here's me, day after day. And he said, the New York Times is executing me, I'm quoting, the New York Times is executing me every day. And are they ever demonic? Ooh. So, number 118, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, Vicar of Christ, Sovereign Pontiff. Though obviously he's all three. But I believe the most important title that we better understand and defend his vicar of Christ. There are bishops now writing articles in nominally Catholic magazines. We are the vicars of Christ. Well, you know, etymologically, you can put all kinds of meanings into words. One says all of us are vicars of Christ because we are somehow to, well, represent Christ or, well, witness to Christ. But the word vicar of Christ has one definite meaning. In that sense, in which the church has over the centuries identified the Pope as the vicar of Christ, there's only one man like that. Now, I think I should say it. Maybe I didn't tell you this. It was Bishop Ortner who said that. Bishop Ortner. Is it any wonder? But we better, for know what we're about, and to be calm and cool. But sleeves of our wheels rolled up. This is the church militant. That's Ignatius. From start to finish. He wasn't a soldier for nothing. That was his training. Today, you remember, his leg shattered in a battle, so he was laid up in bed for months. And the poor guy, say he read novels too. Well, well, pardon me, he used to read novels. But there are no novels. There are novels in those days, remember? Back then. So, there are no novels. All they had around, Ignatius. He had never read a, sure, read his book in his life. The life of Christ and the lives of the saints. Here's a, you know, a soldier lying in bed and climbing the walls. Couldn't do anything. You know, those days didn't have all the means of, you know, surgery or heating limbs or whatever. So he read the life of Christ and read the lives of the saints, and he was an ambitious man. You know, I'd like to become like a Francis of Assisi, like a Dominic. They could do it, so can I. And then, as you know, he wrote the spiritual exercises, and the purpose was to conquer, and the verb is conquer, the world for Christ. In number 119. But it's almost quarter after, isn't it? How about some questions? Please explain masculinity. It's essence in the Holy Trinity. Oh, this is being recorded, I'm sure. Its nature has perfected in Jesus Christ. Nature has the essence of action. How are Roman Catholic men to imitate Jesus Christ in his masculinity? Brothers, be specific. Well, first of all, I explain the masculinity, its essence as a Trinity. Not even the very word masculinity, and now you see a vocabulary. You're just, we've been so shaped by our society. We use words like, well, the culture in which we live uses words. It isn't precisely masculinity that belongs to the Holy Trinity. It is fatherhood that belongs to the Trinity. In other words, the nearest analogy we have, and we're dealing with mystery. None of us will ever fathom the Trinity. But even here on earth, one thing we know about the Trinity, or we better know, is that within the Trinity are three distinct persons. And that one of those three is the origin of the second. And a mutual love between them, first and second, is a third person. But there is, within the Trinity, one person who was the origin. Well, whatever word you use, X, Y, or Z, in procreation or the generation of offspring, there has to be a father who is the origin of the children that he then generates. And there's, you know, the feminism in the world will not change that. I mean, that's the way it is. So that we may say, we better say, that we have what we call generation among human beings. Our human race is generated. And that we take that as a matter of fact. But that it is the highest and deepest analogy for understanding the deepest mystery of our faith. And those who say, and I agree with them, that the highest function of the created world is to provide an understanding of the mysteries of God. So in the Trinity, there is an originator. I repeat, give whatever name you wish. But over the centuries, we have revealed truth is called Him the Father, from whom the Son originates. So, that's why it is not only silly, but a blasphemy against the faith. It's a blasphemy to not identify the Father in the masculine gender. It's a blasphemy. Hope I'm clear. But as by now I know, those who are behind the feminist movement, whether they're not women, in case you don't know, they are men. We're using women. And behind that are the most virulent and well thought out heresies of the faith. And when you read their literature, as I do, I mean the minds behind the feminists with all their bravado, their little dangling, you might say, toys being used by real brains, is a denial of the Trinity. Moreover, and it's not only, this is within the Trinity, but then from the Trinity, God is Creator. Again, either we believe that God is the originator of everything that exists, or we're babbling idiots. Am I making sense? So it's the origination within the Trinity, and then the origination from the Trinity that really is at stake here. And let me tell you, there are many who, how well I know, the largest publishing house in the English language defending what's called process theology, which is underneath all of this. Denying within the Godhead one person who is the originator of the other two, and denying that God is the originator of the whole universe, by the sheer use of his loving will. The largest process theology publishing house in the world in English is the Paulus Press in New Jersey. I should also add, they are the largest publishing house of feminist literature. To go together. Behind feminism, I repeat, is a virulent heresy undermining the foundations of Christianity. His nature is perfected in Jesus Christ. Nature is the essence of action. Now Jesus then, this is now, we're shifting gears because this is now Christ's human nature. In other words, absolutely speaking, might God have become a woman instead of a man? Absolutely speaking, yes. But then, it would have been an implicit denial of the purpose that Christ had for God had becoming a man. In other words, Christ not only symbolizes the Godhead, he is God. And whatever else Christ is, he is the originator as God. And now, once he became man, not only of our creation, but of our redemption. And the bottom line, how well I know, years and years of reading Marx and Engels, and all you name the really intelligent heretics, a lifetime. The real issue is either acceptance or denial of dependence on God. That's the issue. We depend on God. He determines even our very existence. Could be somebody sitting in those two empty chairs, right? Complete dependence on God. How are Roman Catholic men to imitate Jesus Christ in his masculinity? Well, first of all, in his masculinity. Now, again, there's not a cheap phrase. Masculinity is somehow distinct from femininity. Much more fundamental, oh Lord, much more fundamental than the gender that Christ had as man, the masculine gender, is the more fundamental thing that he is God who became man. And therefore, revealing, the origin and the source of everything. And that consequently Christ then was man. Now, once we begin talking this language, I have to say, we become trivial. See, it's trivial. Talk about masculine and feminine qualities. Well, this is in all the literature. Oh, well, I know. See. And whole psychology is built, on the feminine qualities and the masculine qualities. All right. I repeat, that's trivial compared to the real principle which is involved. And that is origination, dependence. And this, of course, is what... And this is where the feminist movement has so drugged millions and millions of men. I know men, how well I know them. In our country, most of the laboring force of America is women, and is rising by about 1% each year. It's about 55% this year. Most of the wealth in the United States is held by women. Most of the voters in the United States are women. Tremendous power. And of course, in the last analysis, all the murder of unborn children. are done by women. Even when there's one young woman that I came to know who had was pregnant out of wedlock, and I spoke to her, and she managed to escape alive because both the father of the child and her own father threw on the floor and literally tried to kill the child in her womb. She was screaming and managed to get to a telephone, called the emergency. The police came and rescued her from that child killed in her womb. But I'm speaking, in other words, there is no way we can appreciate fully what's going on in our country. By the way, this is the judgment of the Holy See. The most devastating evil in the United States is radical feminism. And there are chances now, as you know now, with women running the diocese. So back to this masculinity. Well, obviously, there are certain qualities of leadership. And now, as you know, for gosh, even to say that the man is somehow head of the household, you better watch whom you say that to and how far you are from the person to whom you say it. Generations have been brought up, as you know, in very different cultures of the world. Whole mentality. Gee. Mary is the subject of the attached articles. Three of them appear to question her perpetual virginity. Only the highlighter areas need be read for my questions. This will not distract the intent of the articles. We are not identifying himself as a priest. The author is an associate pastor, ordained 28 years. Would you interpret the highlighted statements as a direct challenge to Mary's virginity or loose theological speculation? What would you be suggested approach in regard to this priest? Can we take a few extra minutes if necessary? Mary's prominent place in our Catholic tradition is a position that she has attained gradually. Scriptures present Mary as being a very low profile, a person who is very much in the background, in contrast to Mary, the mother of Jesus. We can assume that Mary Magdalene's position in the early church was more quickly established. It wasn't until 1964 that Mary was given the title Mother of the Church by Pope Paul VI. Gabriel finds a woman who will listen and tells Mary that she's already blessed. This receptivity that can become so fruitful is called her virginity. It's more a spiritual term than a biological one. Oh, that's an open denial of Mary's virginity. Recently I attended a day of recollection that focused on the role of Mary in the Christian life. Many of the ideas that were presented that day will be worth here our consideration as we celebrate the Feast of the Holy Family. My teacher that day suggested that Jesus may have had brothers and sisters, and what a richer picture this provides for anyone who looks to the Holy Family for help. This suggestion has become scholarly basis and is in harmony with traditional Catholic dogma, which focuses on Jesus as the firstborn rather than the only child. Well, this man is openly heretical. And the name sounds familiar. If the one who could identify where the priest is, I presume he is within reachable distance. Yeah, would you then say after class? But in this, I've said this once before, and I even gave you some kind of an assignment. But let me be a little more formal. Since we are, am I correct, 3 weeks from our next class. Is that right? This, by the way, is exactly what I would want. In other words, I want, because I need, as many such statements in context, in publications, either in books, or articles in newspapers, or pamphlets, or newspapers, or whatever. Well, they should be in print. And they ought to have somebody identified with them, a name. I think I told you that one of my hopes before the Lord called me into eternity is to finish a Summa of Theology. And if you're familiar with St. Thomas' Summa, every article of the Summa has at least 3 objections, in other words, denials. What I need, and this of course will be shared among you, then we can also deal with formal heretics. And they're all over the place. In other words, the more I can get of this, the better. If you can, you know, take a clipping or whatever, then share that with me. If not, then Xerox. And I'd appreciate your highlighting. It makes it much easier to identify and then not to spend a lot of time. And this is needed. And needed by the church. These people have to be refuted. See? And this man is just doing incalculable. Describing Mary as a virgin is more a description of her spiritual state than a biological one. My God. But this is what we're dealing with. And let me be as open as I can. Look. We're living in the most serious crisis in 2,000 years of the church's history. It's a crisis of faith. Now we must pray. God knows we must pray. Live our faith. But for the present purpose of the people that I'm talking to, we must understand what the church believes and teaches. And not just the instinctive sense that this is heresy. It is. But how do you refute it? Did Mary have a spiritual virginity? Of course she did. Did she also have a biological virginity? She better have had. Otherwise, the Apostles' Creed from the first century was a lie. Let me finish if you don't mind. Here's a quote below from the Lateran Council, deemed infallible teaching. Father Edward Bayer expresses concern that I may have gone sadly overboard. God of Father John Myers, rethinking the historical Jesus. I would ask that he reread my original article. I repeat the citation. If anyone does not, according to the Holy Fathers, confess truly and properly that Holy Mary, ever virgin and immaculate, is Mother of God, since in this latter age she conceived in true reality, without human seed from the Holy Spirit, God the Word Himself, who before the age was born of God the Father and gave birth to him without corruption, her virginity remaining equally inviolate after the birth, let him be anathema. So question. Here's a quote below from the Lateran Council, infallible. It sure is. You see, you have to put things together. But then you also got to be able to. You got to explain why mysterious God would have wanted to be conceived and born of a virgin. Why? And the fundamental reason, as far as our reason is concerned, is to make sure that no one would have any doubt that Jesus Christ is God. In other words, that he had no human father because not only was his soul created by God, as ours was too, but his very body came from God. What is the Catholic Services Appeal Collection all about? Who controls the use of the funds collected? I'm not familiar, but I can. Somebody could find out, or if you know, the Catholic Services Appeal Collection. Somebody would report by the next time we meet.